This is Crossroads, a Get Religion podcast.
It has been a very busy year in religion news, there's no doubt about it. A religion angle everywhere you look. The death of Billy Graham, the masterpiece cake shop decision of the U.S. Supreme Court, the Tree of Life synagogue massacre. The Pope is in the news, the Roman Catholic Church and its priestly scandal. Try to put together a top 10 list and you will be challenged. Greetings and welcome to Crossroads with Terry Mattingly. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. Terry Mattingly is Senior Fellow for Media and Religion at the King's College in New York City. He's author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate and the book Pop Goes Religion, and he's founder and editor of Get Religion. Terry, welcome back.
Glad to be here.
You and Religion News Service have a top 10 list. Yours is significantly different in a lot of ways from RNS's list, but you both seem to agree on the top story being something to do with the priestly abuse scandal. Yours is of the McCarrick scandal, that is the question of Cardinal McCarrick and the Vigano letters that alerted the world to these things. And RNS has as its top the Pennsylvania grand jury report released about priestly abuse. Are you guys on the same page?
It's such a big picture, and we're focusing on different aspects of it. The key thing is that I would argue that as important as the grand jury report that came out of Pennsylvania about most of the dioceses of that state, and it's important to realize that several dioceses were not included, including Philadelphia, which is a pretty significant place, that covered seven decades. And depending on how you judge this, if you're looking for priests who are named in that report who remain in ministry, I think there is one who is in ministry still. And in his case, the grand jury or the officials that looked at him decided not to prosecute. It's a report that is so sweeping in how the size of it, but it doesn't really tell us anything new that we didn't already know from several books that have been written about this topic, from the Spotlight series that received the Pulitzer in 2003. And the average priest in this grand jury report, the average alleged incident was in 1979. And what's important about this is that in 2002, 2003, the U.S. Catholic bishops came up with a rather harsh and demanding covenant on how to handle this in cases involving priests. And if you look at the grand jury report, something like 3% of the cases mentioned in the report come after that new policy went into effect. So you could make a case that while the headlines were very important, it was old news, and it was news about an era before this major policy took place. I would argue that the most significant aspect of the Penn grand jury report is that it made big headlines, and thus it inspired a lot of state officials in other states to go after similar long studies of clergy sexual abuse in their own states. It could be that the most important thing that comes out of it is a renewed interest in investigating these crimes, both recent and old. And if that's the case, I mean, you'd have to say that's very important. And I thought this was a very important story. I just thought there was a much more important story this year, which was the fall of Archbishop, former Cardinal Theodore McCarrick, and the fact that the one thing people don't agree on right now is what do you do with bishops who have been accused of sexual abuse themselves and or hiding sexual abuse on their watch? And that's an incredibly important issue, and one that really, at the moment, the Vatican is the only force, the only power with any ability to judge the behavior of bishops, archbishops, and cardinals. And the U.S. Catholic Bishops' Conference tried to set a kind of public policy, or at least set up a structure through which complaints about the behavior of bishop could be received by the church. And the Vatican shut that down, saying, you know, that it wants to do its own study. Now you say, well, that's good. The Vatican wants to handle it. The problem in the McCarrick case is here you have a man of tremendous clout in the national and global Catholic Church, a man who kind of sheepishly boasted in a public address that he played a major role in the election of Pope Francis, or at least assisted in a major move to get this man elected as Pope, the sort of thing that cardinals are not supposed to talk about. It's all supposed to be behind closed doors and hush-hush. More than anything else, McCarrick is a man who was known for having produced a flock of bishops and archbishops who, many would allege, got to where they are through his recommendations. And so he's a man with clout. He's a man with connections. So basically, when the New York Times broke a lot of the news about the accusations against him, including a couple that involved very traditional cases of clergy sexual abuse, which was a male priest sexually abusing teenaged boys after grooming them. Usually the grooming begins at 12 or 13, and then the sexual activity continues throughout their teenaged years. You have a small case of that, but what you had was the first public journalism about rumors that had gone around for literally decades involving this man's habitual or ongoing sexual harassment and abuse of seminarians under his care as a bishop, archbishop, and then cardinal, primarily during his years in Newark. But that, to me, was the bigger scandal. Out of McCarrick came this other story, which was Archbishop Vigano, the former U.S. ambassador to the United States, and his remarkable documents that he released claiming that not only did Pope Francis know about McCarrick, but that he helped shut down the investigations of McCarrick, or that he helped the mechanism in Rome look the other way. And, of course, Vigano suggested that Francis should resign. In the RNA poll, these two stories were listed separately, and the Vigano documents and accusations was considered the number 10 story of the year, and McCarrick was considered number 8. I considered those to be two aspects of the same story, and in my own little personal list, I considered that the top story of the entire year. And then, in another thing that I thought was significant, of the 6 or so people who the RNA nominated to be the Newsmaker of the Year, the Newsmaker of the Year was given to the Presiding Bishop Curry of the Episcopal Church, who was best known this year for preaching a very long and enthusiastic sermon at the royal wedding. That was an interesting news event, but I'm not sure that makes him Newsmaker of the Year compared to, say, the death of Billy Graham. Or, once again, I found it fascinating, they didn't even put McCarrick on the list. Several religion writers have said that they wrote his name in, but if he's not on the list just to be checked off, it's hard for him to be chosen Newsmaker of the Year. And I would think that's exactly what McCarrick was, because McCarrick, who has now been sent off to a monastery in the plains of western Kansas, McCarrick is the living face on the larger issue. I mean, we've had decades of fighting about what to do with predator priests. Well, what do you do with a predator cardinal or archbishop? How do you handle those cases? A lot of conservative Catholics can say, can we trust the bureaucracy of the Vatican to handle these cases honestly, when McCarrick is such a major player in Vatican circles as a fundraiser, as a kingmaker, etc.? I thought that was far and away the bigger story of the year.
Your number 2 was Pope Francis dealing with China on bishops. That did not even make the Religion News Writers list, if I'm not mistaken. Why was it your number two?
Well, first of all, the size of China, the fact that this kind of was a remarkable Vatican decision. I guess my standards for what the biggest news story is how big is the story now, how many people is it affected, and what kind of significance does this story have shaping news in the future? And this fundamental change in the nature of the Roman Catholic Church in China, to where the government of China now is an active player in the appointment of Catholic bishops in that country. I mean, has that ever been the case in the modern era anywhere in Catholicism? I don't know if both sides had the ability to trump the choices of the other, but it's very clear right now in the initial choices that China got its way. And you have several men now serving as bishops in the Roman Catholic Church in China who were previously considered excommunicated or having no sacramental standing at all. And several men who were Vatican-approved bishops are no longer bishops. And the fact that this is all happening this year during the midst of a major crackdown on minority religions in China, including the massive and incredibly important, when you look at the long view, incredibly important underground Church of China, I thought that was of tremendous and lasting impact. And to me, things don't get much bigger than what happens in China.
You had the death of Billy Graham as your number six, but the Religion News Writers put it as their number three. So you, in that case, demoted the story that probably, I'm sure you would agree, in any other year might have been one or two.
When Billy Graham dies and he isn't the newsmaker of the year or way, way, way up in the list, that says something about how much significant religion news happened this year. And if people are going to chide me for putting Billy Graham at six, let's go ahead and just read my list, and then we can kind of compare that to the RNA list, because until I get something up on Get Religion later, people don't have the ability to see my list. I had put the McCarrick scandal and the Vigano letters. I put that number one. I put Pope Francis's deal with China on the appointment of Catholic bishops number two. I put the Tree of Life massacre in Pittsburgh and the growing wave of anti-Semitism in a lot of Western cultures, especially in Europe. But this is, you know, a horrific event here in the United States, the worst ever act of anti-Semitism in the United States, I believe many called it. Number four, I put the Penn grand jury. Number five, I put the firing of Paige Patterson at Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary. And to me, that included the entire year in the whole Me Too sexual abuse angle within evangelicalism. And that was a very big story when you consider the Hybels case and you consider a lot of the other things perking. But Paige Patterson, don't forget, is one of the two men who led the conservative revolt against the old establishment of the Southern Baptist Convention. So the SBC taking down a man who was arguably one of the most powerful figures in the Southern Baptist Convention over the last 40 years, that's a huge story. Number six, the death of Billy Graham. Number seven, the Masterpiece Cake Shop decision. And I would like to stress again, in a normal year, that would be higher too, except that the Supreme Court kind of punted on the actual First Amendment themes in that case. It kind of made a very narrow decision about this one case based on the animus of some public figures. Number eight, the release of Asia Bibi in Pakistan, to where she now remains in hiding. And it's really getting amazing, the nations that are refusing to take her as a political prisoner, including Great Britain. Number nine, the dispute between Constantinople and Moscow over the status of the church in Ukraine. And you say, well, maybe I picked that one because I'm Orthodox. No, I would say this is a dispute that now could conceivably go on for decades, affecting the second largest church in the world with major sacramental schism you know, in Eastern Orthodoxy. This is a very important case. And Moscow is, of course, the largest church in Eastern Christianity. And then you have Constantinople, this tiny, beleaguered, persecuted church in Constantinople. But it's the home to the ecumenical patriarch, who many journalists continue to think is some sort of Orthodox pope. And then my 10th most important story, because of what it said about Bates, about missionaries and a lot of other things, was the John Allen Chow death in India. So those were my 10, and exactly half of my top 10 did not make the list of the top 10 stories at the RNA.
And why do you think that is? Why do you have five stories that didn't make the Religion News Service poll?
I don't know. When you look at the RNA list, okay, let's read it so that listeners have a chance. You can see these things online, but listeners don't have a chance to compare, and I know it's hard to put all this in their mind, but I'll flag a few things that I didn't think were as important. Okay, first of all, the Tree of Life Synagogue massacre was the number two story at RNA, and I don't have much dispute with that. Billy Graham is number three. Like I said, in any ordinary year, that would be way up. We begin to get a run of some other things I didn't think were as important. Number four, they put the ecumenical opposition to Donald Trump's border policies as the number four religion story. I agree that's a very significant thing. It did not make my top 10. The cake shop ruling is number five in the RNA list. Number six, White House approved the U.S. Embassy move to Israel. Now, one of the reasons why I didn't think that was as significant is a lot of people, including, I believe, Barack Obama, have called for that move in the past, but nobody did anything about it. And at this point, Trump has called for it, but, you know, maybe it'll be significant when it happens. I thought that was important, but not in the top 10. And once again, in an ongoing run of political stories, RNA number seven, Supreme Court upholds the Muslim ban, the Trump administration policy. Finally, we get McCarrick at eight. Number nine was a kind of generic religious minorities elected to Congress item, politics again. And then their number 10 was the Vigano story. Again, I considered that a part of my number one story with McCarrick. So I think I was not as driven to name Trump-related stories in the top 10 this year. I guess I'm not that impressed with the actions of Donald Trump, but looking at my list this year, I had a very high percentage of internationals this year, higher maybe than normal in the past. I'm really surprised the Paige Patterson and evangelical Me Too story didn't get more play from the RNA, in the sense that I think a lot of people don't understand that the sexual abuse issue is shaped differently in the world of Protestantism and in the world of secular public schools, for that matter, but that the numbers are very, very high. Maybe I was biased because I've been covering the Southern Baptist story so long, and I think that's one of the most important religious stories in American religious history in the last half century or so. The fall of someone the size of Paige Patterson is really quite amazing.
And if I recall, it was kind of a drawn-out affair, wasn't it?
It was just one story. Yes, and it got a lot of very significant coverage in the Washington Post, primarily through the writing of Sarah Pulliam Bailey. No, that was a huge story, and I think it's very important. You often will hear Catholics complain that sexual abuse, you know, in Catholic circles gets all of the coverage and it doesn't get any coverage elsewhere. Well, in this case, I think this was a year. If you look at Protestant Christianity in America over the last 20 years, Paige Patterson and Bill Hybels would both have to be in the top 10 most powerful figures in evangelical Protestantism over the last 10 to 20 years. Would you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, so that's, you put that together. I mean, the Protestant Me Too story, and for me, Paige Patterson was the symbol of that this year. to me, that's an incredibly important story.
Do you think that perhaps the Religion News Writers Association, the people casting their votes, simply either folded Paige Patterson into Me Too, or they thought it maybe belonged in the category or in a nearby category to the McCarrick stuff, and didn't know what to do with it?
Well, I think if you put Paige Patterson, they often combine cases into a trend, and in effect, that's what I was doing as well. To me, by saying that Paige Patterson was the face of the Me Too scandal this year, Hybels was the face of that scandal the previous year, and there were significant Hybels developments this year as well. That's a big, big story. Here's what I fear, and I have written about this in the past, and I think there is a tendency to believe that religion stories are important to the degree they affect politics, because politics, after all, is the religion of the American news industry. Sometimes we get caught up in the fact that a religion story is important to the degree that it affects partisan politics. And of course, right now you have the exploding supernova of Donald Trump that just seems to attract ink and coverage no matter what. I think once again that Trump was a big factor here, but an even bigger factor is if it's a political religion angle, that automatically has to be real important. For me this year, I just looked at the numbers of the size of the groups involved in both the Orthodox story, the Protestant Me Too story, the China story. I looked at some of these things, and that made them things that simply had to be in the top 10.
I wanted to come back to the Tree of Life massacre because it is, I think, the biggest violent anti-Semitic incident on U.S. soil, but it also has a context in the threats of fascism on both sides, the constant invocation of Nazi Germany. There's a Me Too angle to there, the Women's March. Some of its leaders have affinities for Louis Farrakhan, who's openly anti-Semitic. There's a lot there that serves as context for that perhaps isolated incident of anti-Semitic violence.
Yeah, the Tree of Life is the American face of an absolutely horrific year in terms of global news about anti-Semitism. And all the way back 15, 16 years ago in West Palm Beach, I had a chance to, I was living there at the time, teaching at Palm Beach Atlantic University, and I did an interview with some young Jewish young people who were headed to Israel as a part of a program that would allow American young Jews to take trips to Israel and learn more about the history of that nation, etc. Well, there was this one young woman who was going, and her plans were to go over there on this free ticket and then just stay. And she was extremely confident that she could get a job. Everybody around the table seemed to agree with that. And I finally said, hold it, am I missing something here? Why are y'all all so confident that she's going to go over to Israel and just immediately be able to get a job? And they said, oh, because she's in real estate and she speaks French. Well, you get the connection. Already at that point, so many French Jews were fleeing because of the trends in their own country in terms of anti-Semitism and immigration that they were concerned about, etc. Because she spoke fluent French and worked in real estate, they said she's just going to immediately be grabbed by some Israeli real estate agency to have someone who can sell properties to French Jews and speaks the language. I believe that interview was in 2004. So the trends have just continued to escalate and escalate in terms of the number of Jews beginning to flee Europe. So the Tree of Life, once again, is an American image on a bigger issue in Western Europe, Eastern Europe, I mean Europe in general, and the Western world. I would agree with you there.
Let's talk some more about the death of Billy Graham, which proved to be not only a retrospective on a truly remarkable life and career of both evangelist and, can we say, kind of quasi-politician. He was the voice whispering in presidents' ears before that was the popular thing for evangelicals to do, but also a life that reflected American evangelicalism's strange changes over about 100 years.
Yeah. Listeners may remember from previous conversations that back in the mid-80s, right before the Rocky Mountain Crusade in Denver, I had a chance to spend almost an entire day with Billy Graham at his offices in Black Mountain, Montreat, North Carolina. And during that day, I asked him for his definition of evangelical, an issue that was already big in the 80s and has only gotten bigger and more divisive in the decades since then. And at that time, I thought it was significant that Billy Graham said he had no idea what the word evangelical meant. And I kind of chuckled in his face and said, "Sir, let's get real. If you don't know what the word evangelical means, then who does?" And he laughed and kind of acknowledged that. He said, "But the big issue is, to what degree is the word evangelical something that can be defined by doctrine as opposed to subculture?" Now, I want listeners to hear that, because I think it's very significant when you look at the second half of the career of Billy Graham. And let's say that Billy Graham post-Nixon tapes, I mean, in the sense that you have, as you said, Billy Graham, the president whisperer before that, although I would argue that they were using him infinitely more than he was using them in terms of influence. After this crushing revelations of what was on the Nixon tapes, which Billy Graham owned up to and repented of very openly, from that moment on, and I interviewed him about that, I also had long conversations with his brother-in-law and his sister, Leighton Ford. Graham decided that the future of evangelicalism was in the global South and in the Third World and China. He thought the underground church was, you know, incredibly important. And of course, he was married to a woman who was born in China. His wife was the daughter of Chinese missionaries. China was always on Ruth Bell Graham's mind. Graham kind of repented, not just of his actions, but repented of being so American-centric. And this led to the Lausanne Committee on World Evangelization. And with that, Graham adopted a much more global perspective on what the word evangelical means. And for him, it became much more a matter of doctrine as opposed to American subcultures. So I think the further we get away from Billy Graham, the preacher in the Crusades, as important as that was, I really think one of his lasting legacies is going to be the degree to which he and the Lausanne Committee, along with J.I. Packer, Leighton Ford, John Stott, and a bunch of others, the degree to which they helped raise up third world evangelicals, especially in Africa and Asia, I think we're going to end up thinking of that as one of his biggest contributions of his life, if not his major contribution to global Christianity, as opposed to the American subculture of evangelicalism. Does that make sense?
I did want to ask you about an entire generation of evangelicals for whom Billy Graham is just a picture in a magazine, because he spent the latter, what, probably 20 years of his life, not as a recluse, but certainly not in the public eye as he had beforehand.
Well, that's true. I mean, the Rocky Mountain Crusade in the 80s was already being hailed as one of his final crusades. Now stop and think about that. That's the 80s. You know, 80s, 90s, aughts. I mean, just run it out in your mind. He was already considered the elder statement of evangelicalism in the 80s. So, I mean, there have been symbolic moments involving Graham in the last decade or decade and a half, but nothing that parallels his earlier career. When Graham died, I focused my column about his death on his sermon at the public memorial service for the Oklahoma City bombing. And I focused on that sermon instead of his remarks at the 9/11 because, frankly, I thought he spoke with more freedom in Oklahoma. And I thought his remarks at 9/11 were much more restricted, kind of by politicians asking him to make sure he was extremely, extremely ecumenical and careful. Whereas, you know, with Bill and Hillary Clinton sitting in the front row and Bill Clinton speaking first, followed by Billy Graham, or speaking ahead of Billy Graham, how often is there a man who speaks after a president in a public meeting of that sort? That tells you something about Graham's clout, you know, in Oklahoma and in the Bible Belt. You could have given an altar call at the end of Graham's sermon on that date. He was explicit. He talked about heaven. He talked about Jesus Christ as Savior. He talked about all kinds of things that you really can't do that anymore. So part of our significance of Graham leaving as well is I think Graham's death helps close the door, except for maybe that core group of people who think they have major sway over Trump. I think evangelicals who know what's up are beginning to realize that they are an influential minority in American culture, a thought that probably is best symbolized by the contents of the book Onward by Russell Moore of the Southern Baptist Convention, a kind of make Christianity strange again, and certainly make evangelical strange again. Because the truth is, in the context of broader beliefs in American culture, traditional forms of Christianity are now strange. During the decades of the career of Billy Graham, I think it was easier to think of Billy Graham as somehow normal or someone that, for whom all Americans would agree on his stature. If Billy Graham was 40 years old today and was saying what he was saying when he was 40 years old or even saying what he was saying when he was 80 years old, Billy Graham would be a figure of tremendous controversy in American life today.
Your number 7, RNA's number 5, the Masterpiece Cake Shop decision, was obviously a big story, but it was also not only because it went to the Supreme Court, although kind of ambiguously decided, but it was also big because of the context of the Supreme Court. And looking back on it, the changes that would soon
come. The changes on the court, yes. We don't have a real religious liberty case coming out of the current court, but I think we will have one fairly soon. I can't see that not coming up again. And, of course, it didn't make as many headlines, but the state of Colorado went right back after Phillips again. So maybe they're going to try to do it this time with less animus, since Justice Kennedy, the king of America, as I used to say until he retired, he admitted in this very explicitly, "I am not settling the religious liberty elements of this case. I am not settling. We are not settling the First Amendment grounds of this case. We're saying that there was open prejudice displayed against this man by Colorado, and they should cut that out." So he freely admitted that he had not settled it. So that's another reason why, for me, this case is not as important as it might have been otherwise.
Your number 8 and your number 10 could have fallen into one category, the Asia Bibi case of religious persecution under Islam. And then I guess you can count this as religious persecution when John Allen Chau is killed. Why don't you think religious persecution in general makes lists like this? Because it's quite prevalent. Now, those are just two isolated incidences.
Well, I would separate those two. I sincerely would. Asia Bibi is a classic case of a religious minority. The parallel case to her is the massacre of Coptic Christians on pilgrimages in Egypt, and some of the other things that have happened in recent years into Egypt. That, to me, would be the parallel. What makes the John Allen Chau case so significant is the fervor it has stirred up about the work of missionaries and whether missionary work itself is a form of attack on the cultures of other lands, and whether you could hear people almost calling for missionaries, evangelistic missionaries, to be banned. And this is when you consider that in the UN Declaration of Human Rights, the ability to change your faith is a protected religious rights, religious liberty issue on the global level, according to the UN. Now, someone might say that's a separate issue than whether someone gets to preach for the conversion of others. Well, I don't know how people convert and change their faith if they're not exposed to another faith. I can give you a parallel case in my own mixed feelings about it. In the wake of the breakup of the Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc, you had millions of dollars of missionary efforts poured into Russia and other parts of the Eastern Orthodox world to convert some Orthodox Christians away from this fake religion of Orthodoxy and to the true faith of evangelical Protestantism. Well, Russia has taken strong actions to help prevent that. And even though I understand the pain of the Russian church, I don't think that's wise. I don't think you can limit the freedom of people to preach the gospel according to their beliefs and for other people to respond to that. So what we had here in his case, especially, was it Ed Stetzer that wrote a piece detailing the fact that this guy had undergone more training than the secular stories and coverage made it, and that, of course, these people were protected in part because this tribe would be very open to disease. Well, he had lived in quarantine for a lengthy period of time, had been barraged with anecdotes to where he was as clean as he could get himself, and he was not planning on going in, standing on the beach and preaching evangelistic sermons. His goal was to go in, try to figure out how this language works, and begin establishing some sort of relationship with the tribe, a tribe that has made it very clear they had no intention of having relationships with anybody. So he had a very risky mission. Well, to be honest with you, when I read those stories, I thought of the Orthodox missionaries who died in Alaska in the early stages of Russian Orthodox missionary work with the Eskimo and the Aleut tribes. I mean, and where you had men go in, several named saints, who essentially just sat on islands and spent their life praying for the conversion of the Aleut people. And then eventually people began to get in boats and approach the shore, and some of them died. You have an icon at the on the wall of the church that I attended in Baltimore, Holy Cross Orthodox in Linthicum, that had a collection of the saints of North America. And one of the things I thought was beautiful about that icon is that you had a martyred missionary in that icon, and then you had one of the Aleut young men who killed him went on to become a Christian and later became a saint himself. And I thought, well, there's an interesting statement. You know, a man who dies and the man who killed him are both standing in the same icon as saints of the Orthodox faith. Well, missionaries have always been controversial. And this case that blew up right toward the end of the year, I can think of some other things I might have put number 10, but that one received so much coverage right at the end of the year that I included it at the bottom of my list.
So what's the best piece of advice that you can give to reporters if they're covering religion-related stories in the coming year?
Number one, I would advise them to second-guess their automatic impulse to say that something is important because it's linked to American politics. That would be number one. That's not going to surprise you. That's a theme I've said forever. Politics comes and goes. It runs hot, it runs cold, whereas some of these global changes, like the China church situation, this is a change that's going to have an impact in China potentially forever. I don't know what will happen to the massive underground Catholic church in China now under this ruling. I mean, don't forget that for some time during the John Paul era, there was a man living in China who was a cardinal. yet was living in complete anonymity to anyone in the Chinese government and even a lot of church officials. He was in pectore, I believe is the Latin phrase for. He was a cardinal in the Pope's heart. Only the Pope knew. I mean, he could have been a mechanic. He could have been a nurse in a hospital. He could have been all kinds of things. But he was known to the Pope of Rome that he was actually a cardinal of the Roman Catholic Church. That gives you some idea of the stature of the underground church of China in the mind of many people within Catholicism. Well, that's gone? Or is it? Do we now have a recognized Catholic Church in China cooperating with the government? Are we now going to have an underground Catholic Church in China that is now separate from Rome? A church that's operating maybe in a pre-Vatican II fashion? That's a huge story. I don't know how we cover it, but it's significant. So number one, question whether something is important just because it's related to Donald Trump and American politics. Maybe your editors think that's important, but question that. And then number two, I would look for global lasting impact. And Supreme Court cases, I think, are tremendously important when you get clarity. So when I look at the China story, when I look at the Tree of Life story, when I look at the Billy Graham story, when I look at the Asiah Bibi story and the Ukraine story, I see global issues in religion that are going to be around for a long time. If Asiah Bibi is martyred before she and her family can get out of Pakistan, I will think that's a very, very big story. When you consider the plight of Christians living under persecution in a lot of lands in the world, I certainly think she deserved to be in the top 10.
With only 30 seconds here, Terry, what do you think the top religion story will be in 2019?
It'll be something about Donald Trump. How's that for safe? Or it will be something about sexual abuse in the Roman Catholic Church. I'm being cynical, but you watch. It could conceivably have something to do with the beginning of the presidential race, because after all, what could conceivably be more important in the world than who is elected president of the United States?
Terry Mattingly is senior fellow for media and religion at the King's College in New York City. He's author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate and the book Pop Goes Religion, and he's founder and editor of Get Religion. Terry, thanks.
Glad to be here.
I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Crossroads with Terry Mattingly.
Crossroads is a joint production of GetReligion.org and Issues Etc.